apology for one of the things I said last night. I mistakenly said that the brass and the iron are not in Daniel 2. They are, of course. The third empire, brass, third kingdom of brass, the brazen-coated Greeks. And that goes right back to Homer, who lived in the 8th century, about the time of Josiah, biblically. He called the Greeks the brazen-coated Greeks, and so they were. And the Iron of Rome is there as well, so apologies for that one. So we move today to Revelation chapter 6, and what we're going to do over today is we're going to look at those three sections that we saw last night, the seals, the trumpets, and the vials. First of all, in Revelation chapter 6, judgment on pagan Rome. Then in the trumpets, judgment on Christian Rome in the west and in the east. And then the vials, judgment on holy Rome. So all the focus, as we're going to see, is on Rome. So, question, what are the seals about? Well, we looked last night at preterite view, and the preterite view would say that the seals are about the siege and conquest of Jerusalem in AD 70. The continuous historic view, as I've just said, judgments on pagan Rome, from AD 96, when Revelation was written, to AD 324, when Constantine's in full control of the whole of the Roman Empire. And the futurist view merely says it's the forces of evil operating on the earth during the Christian period. Do we need to sort the problem out? Okay, are we good to go? Sounds a bit better. So, history of these three views. We looked last night and saw that the Jesuits produced the futurist view and the preterite view to try and divert Protestant attention away from the papacy. But in actual fact, these futurist and preterite views go back to biblical times. So, if we turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2, 2 Timothy chapter 2. Where Paul's exhorting Timothy to study to show himself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And that's what we all need to do. Verse 16, but shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness. And their word will eat of doth a canker, of whom is Hymenaeus and Philetus, who concerning the truth averred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrow the faith of some. So there were preterites in the first century ecclesia. Oh, the resurrection's already happened. Remember, when Jesus was raised from the dead, the graves were opened, and many of the saints arose and went into Jerusalem and talked to people and convinced them that they had been risen from the dead. That's the resurrection. It's already happened. And Paul says, that's an error of the truth. So the interpretation of prophecy is not sort of some sort of add-on extra to the fundamentals that we believe. It's part of the truth. And this wrong concept of prophecy overthrew the faith of some. So it was around there in the first century. And then the futurist view, if we go to 2 Peter chapter 3, another wonderfully prophetic chapter. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 4, or verse 3 for the context. There shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Prophecy isn't being fulfilled now. Everything's just going on. It's all in the future. Verse 16. So, verse 15 for the context. As our brother Paul, according to the wisdom given unto him, hath written unto you, as also in all his epistles, speaking in them of these things, in which are some things hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned and unstable wrest, as they do also the other scriptures, unto their own destruction. So, Peter is saying, Paul's epistles are scripture. He's written about these things in the future, particularly 2 Thessalonians 2. And those who are unstable and in the ecclesia rest, they twist these words of Paul and make them mean something different. And in this context, they push everything on into the future. If you investigate Jonathan Burke's book, A More Sure Word of Prophecy, he shows that the understanding of the seals in Revelation, the continuous historic, goes back to 300 AD, which is before they were all fulfilled. People at the time they were being fulfilled understood this was a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. So we're going to look at the seals, the trumpets, and the vials today. Just a quickie, there are also, of course, in Revelation, these beasts. There's the great red dragon in chapter 12 with 7 heads and 10 horns. There's the beast that we looked at last night that comes out of the sea with 7 heads and 10 horns. And there's the beast in Revelation chapter 17 with 7 heads and 10 horns. And we saw last night that the 7 heads and the 10 horns come straight out of Daniel chapter 7. So all of these beasts are Roman beasts. And the sixth seal, we're going to see, parallels Revelation chapter 12, where we've got the defeat of the great red dragon. So, quick look at the time scale. These are the things to put in your margin, and I think they will come up in the slides as we go through. But the first seal, AD 96 to 180. The second seal, 180 to 211. The third, 211 to 235. The fourth, 235 to 305. The fifth is quite short. And then the sixth seal, AD 312, Battle of Milvian Bridge, which we will look at, to Constantine being established as the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. So, what did John see? He saw 4 horses with riders on them. As we've read, the pale horse, the red horse, the black horse, and the chloritic horse. He's a sort of yellowy-green colour. Looks very sick. So here's the first one. He's a white horse. Find Revelation 6. He's a white horse, and him that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. The time from AD 96 was a wonderful time in the Roman Empire. It was a time of peace and prosperity from AD 96 to 180, a period of 84 years. And during that period, the apostles and their successors went out and they preached the truth in the Roman Empire. There were a number of emperors in that period of time. I'm not going to go through the details of all of them, because when we get to the fourth seal, that would take the rest of the day. But this is what the historian Edward Gibbon wrote about this period. Gibbon wrote 6 volumes of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and he chronicled the events in the Roman Empire until its demise. And he talks about this time as an amazing time of peace and prosperity and happiness, from the death of Domitian, who we looked at last night, in whose reign John wrote the Apocalypse, to the accession of Commodus. And it was called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. It was a wonderful time of peace, and God ordained this so that the truth could be preached throughout the Roman Empire. But it came to an end. So the second horse came forth. Verse 3, when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth. So that confirms that under the first horse, the white horse, It was a time of peace. And when the red horse came forth, peace disappeared. And that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. So that's the period from AD 180 to 211, when there was great bloodshed in the Roman Empire. They're the Caesars who reigned over that period. And it was a terrible time of bloodshed as God started to punish the pagan Romans for their idolatry and their wickedness. And then came the third seal, the black horse, a time of famine in the Roman Empire from AD 211 to 235, because the emperors so misruled the Roman Empire that commerce and farming just collapsed. The farmers couldn't get sufficient money for their crops, so they stopped bothering to grow crops, and the famine spread throughout the empire. So there's the emperors of the third seal. And we read in verse 5, when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast, the third living creature, say, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. So a measure is turnips, and it's a dry measure, and it's less than a quart or 1 litre. It would just about support a man of moderate appetite for a day. And it was a measure of wheat for a penny. And a penny was what a man earned in a day. So the whole of a man's income was going on food. That was the state of the Roman Empire under the black horse. And Gibbon comments, a long and general famine was a calamity. It was a consequence of the behavior of the Roman emperors, who basically stopped the produce of the present and the hope of the future harvests by their mismanagement of the economy. Well, we might think British economy is in a bit of a mess. There's inflation, food prices are going up. Well, it was far, far, far worse in the Roman Empire under the time of the black horse. And so we come to the fourth horse, the yellowy green chloritic horse, which brought disease. Now, you've seen the slide of the Roman emperors in the first three seals, just a few of them. This period was 70 years, and that's how many emperors reigned. There was murder and assassination among the emperors on a regular basis. And Gibbon comments, the furious plague, which was from 250 to 265, ravished every province of the Roman Empire, every city, almost every family. 5,000 people dying every day in Rome. War, pestilence, and famine had consumed half of the human species. That was the state of affairs that God brought upon these pagans. And he comments again, the empire was oppressed and almost destroyed by the soldiers, the tyrants, and the barbarians. So that's the state the empire was reduced to by the time of the fourth horse. And then Emperor Diocletian came to the throne. He became the emperor, and he said, Roman Empire is too big for one man to rule. And so he divided it into four. He appointed himself as the head, and under him were two Augusti and two Caesars who reigned in those parts of the Roman Empire. And just notice over in Britain, there is Constantius, who ruled in Britain. He actually ruled from York. That was his headquarters. And we'll see a bit more about what came from him later on. And Maxentius ruled in Rome. So we come to the fifth seal. and given comments. It was the first duty of a Christian to preserve himself pure and undefiled from the practice of idolatry. And they disdained every earthly and corporal delight. They kept themselves separate from the evils and the wickedness of the Roman Empire. And that's a lesson for us in this evil and wicked world. They said marriage was supremely important. And marriage, of course, was marriage between a man and a woman. It's a resemblance, they said, of the union between Christ and the Ecclesia. And it's indissoluble. There can be no divorce. That was the view of the faithful in the fourth century. The Christians did not try to defend themselves or their property. They just patiently waited for the purpose of God to be worked out. They refused to take any active part in the civil administration of the military defence of the empire. And that's where we stand. We take exactly the same view as those faithful brothers and sisters in the fourth century, despite all the persecution that was going on around them. So, back to the emperors. Constantius in York died, and his soldiers appointed his son Constantine as emperor in the West. And so we come to the sixth seal, verse 12 of Revelation 6. I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth, even as a fig tree casts her untimely figs when she's shaken with a mighty wind. The heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. So there's a great earthquake. Anybody know how many great earthquakes there are in the book of Revelation?
Three.
Correct. There are three great earthquakes. There are other earthquakes, but there's three great ones. So Revelation 6, verse 12, the sixth seal, the fall of pagan Rome. Revelation 11, verse 13, the sixth trumpet, the fall of France, the French Revolution, which set all sorts of things in train, as we shall see tonight. And Revelation 16, verse 18, the seventh vial, the fall of Great Babylon. We don't have a date for that at the moment, but it's coming. The other two happen. The third one will. So there's a lot of detail in those verses 12 to 14 of Revelation chapter 6. And Revelation chapter 6 is expanded in Revelation chapter 12. The sixth seal is so important that the events of it get almost another chapter in Revelation. So there's some parallels between Revelation chapter 6 and Revelation chapter 12. The sun and the moon darkened, and in Revelation chapter 12, the sun and the moon are bright. So if you look at Revelation chapter 12, there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. How many stars are there on the European flag? The EU flag? 12. And they come straight out of this chapter, because the Catholics believe that this woman is Mary. And I've got a slide which isn't in this presentation, which shows a Catholic depiction of Mary with the sun around her head and 12 stars encircling the sun and the moon under her feet. But in that picture, she's got something else under her foot. It's the serpent. Because the Catholics believe that it is Mary who crushes the serpent, and they've changed the wording in Genesis chapter 3 so that they say that she shall crush thy head and thou shalt crush her heel. They make it all of Mary. So to the Catholics, this is a depiction of Mary, but in actual fact, it's a picture of pagan Rome, this apostate woman. And In verse 13 of Revelation 6, we've got the stars of heaven falling to the earth, and the same thing in chapter 4. And it's interesting to discuss Revelation chapter 12 with a Jehovah's Witness, because they are convinced that the war in heaven that verse 7 of chapter 12 speaks about took place in 1914, when the devil was thrown out of heaven and came to the earth and has been ruling the earth ever since. And they have to admit that so many details in this chapter are, in actual fact, figurative. They cannot be literal. So how can the woman be clothed with the sun when the temperature of the sun is about 5.5 million degrees? How can she have her feet on the moon when there's no atmosphere on the moon? She can't breathe. And how can the tail of this dragon cast a third part of the stars, which man still can't count, to the surface of this little planet? When did that happen in history? And obviously they don't know. They have to say, oh, that detail's figurative. So the question you ask them when they've had to admit that so many of the details in the first six verses are figurative is, how can you be so certain, and where is your evidence that the war in heaven is literal between Michael and his angels and your devil and his angels? And they don't have an answer to that question. But the great red dragon of Revelation chapter 12 is pagan Rome, and he was overthrown by Constantine, the man whom God had appointed. And if you look down in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 10, when the dragon's cast out, John says in verse 10 of Revelation 12, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. So the persecution by the pagan Roman emperors was brought to an end. And verse 11, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of the testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. So verse 10 says, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. And they really thought like that. Here's a quotation from the Roman historian Eusebius, who lived at the time of Constantine, and comments on the great change that happened in the Roman Empire when Constantine took the purple and became emperor. So they said it was on a religious basis. Constantine claimed he'd seen this dream of the cross and been told, in this strength you conquer. And just look at the bit in green. All the nations, being set free from the calamities which had heretofore beset them, cease not to praise Constantine as the victorious, the pious, the common benefactor. All indeed with one voice and one mouth declared that Constantine had appeared by the grace of God as a general blessing to mankind. That was what the contemporary historian wrote about the huge change in the Roman Empire as a result of this great earthquake that happened in AD 312 when Constantine overthrew the pagan emperor Maxentius. And Constantine in 313, 1 year after he came to power, issued what's called the Edict of Milan, and he says that he granted to the Christians and others full authority to observe the religion which each preferred. So instead of persecuting the Christians, Constantine allowed them complete freedom of worship. And Lactantius, who's another Roman historian from the time, says, and thus from the overthrow of the church until its restoration, there was a space of 10 years and about 4 months. The persecution ended and Constantine gave them freedom of religion. When Constantine won the Battle of Milvian Bridge, he was very annoyed that the Praetorian Guard, who were the elite of the Roman army, whose job was to guard the Roman Emperor, the Praetorian Guard had taken the side of his enemy Maxentius. So when Constantine secured the power in Rome, he dismissed the Praetorian Guard and he razed their barracks to the ground. But in the middle of their barracks, there was a little pagan temple. And Constantine said, we won't destroy that. What shall I do with it? So he offered it to the Bishop of Rome and said to the Bishop of Rome, would you like this pagan temple and make it into one of your places of worship? And the Bishop of Rome said, yes, thank you very much. And so the Bishop of Rome converted it and he called it Domus Dei, the House of God. It's now called the Basilica of St. John Lateran. It is the Pope's personal cathedral. The word cathedral comes from the Latin word cathedra, which means a chair. And according to Catholic doctrine, when the Pope sits in his chair in his cathedral and pronounces on faith or morals, he is infallible. So in actual fact, the Basilica of St. John Lateran in Rome is, in Catholic terms, the holiest place in the world. There's a staircase called the Scala Sancta, the holy staircase, which you're not allowed to go up on your feet, you have to go up on your knees. And at the top of that staircase, there is a room that only the Pope can go into. It's full of relics. It's called the Holy of Holies. So this is how they define St. John Lateran. How's your Latin? Would you like an English translation? Well, there it is. The Archbasilica of the Most Holy Saviour and Saints, John the Baptist and the Evangelist, at the Lateran, of all the churches in the city and the world, the Mother and the Head. And that's what they claim they are. The Mother Church and the Head Church over all the churches of the world. And of course, we totally do not accept that claim. And at least three Christadelphians have told me that they have been told by Catholic priests, when we get our power back, you Christadelphians are the first ones we're going to destroy. We hate you because you call us the beast. But that's what the Book of Revelation teaches, that organisation has always been persecuting those who hold the truth. So, Constantine's victory, Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. This is what Constantine himself wrote. Now that liberty is restored, and that serpent, the dragon is called a serpent in Revelation 12, that serpent is driven from the administration of public affairs by the providence of the supreme God and our instrumentality. We trust that all can see the efficacy of the divine power. So Constantine believed that he was the instrument of God in overthrowing the pagan Roman Empire. Indeed he was, and he recognized it. And when we come to tonight's class and look at chapter 16, we're going to find people like Napoleon and Nelson, who also believed they were the instruments of God, that they were men that God had raised up to do his will. Nelson prayed before every battle that he might do the will of God. Napoleon said, I am in the hand of Providence. She will use me as she will, and then she will break me like a glass. And so Constantine had a coin minted in AD 327. Once he had consolidated his power over the Roman Emperor, the Roman Empire. So there he is on the front of the coin. And on the reverse of the coin is his standard. And the two Greek letters, Chi and Rho, which are the first two letters of the name Christ, or the title Christ. And look what the standard is doing. It is piercing the serpent, the dragon. And so, through these six seals, God worked out his purpose to overthrow the pagan Roman Empire and bring in a completely different dispensation. And Constantine believed that he was accomplishing the will of God. So the fit of history of the times into the details of the symbol of Revelation is plain to see. It is wonderful how God has recorded these things symbolically, and we can see that the symbols fit exactly the events of the time. So that's a long time ago, but the very fact that the details were outworked in the way that God has intended should encourage us that as God has used leaders in the past, so he is doing now. And it's going to be very interesting. I don't know whether you've seen the news this morning, but Mr. Prigozhin, who's the head of the Wagner mercenaries who've been fighting in the Ukraine, has turned his attention to the Russian defense minister, and he says we've got to bring him down. And the mercenaries have taken over the city of Rostov-on-Don, and Mr. Putin is saying they're stabbing the Russian nation in the back. So things are quite exciting in Russia this morning. But have a look at the news and see what's happening. So that's the first six seals. In the next class, we shall move on, God willing, to the trumpets.